It's great to be here. You know, my wife says that the most terrifying sight is about walking up to a microphone with a heap of books in his hand. We'll make it painless. The first poem I want to read is an older one. Dennis O'Driscoll, late Dennis O'Driscoll, poet, was a good friend to several of us in this room. And Dennis and I had an ongoing dialogue about the need, an ongoing conversation about the need for poets to have a job. He was in the Revenue Commissioners and I was in the Irish Times. And the title of this poem is a phrase that he used in one of our conversations, and it was about the need. It was actually put, the poem is entitled Putting on the Grey Suit. I wasn't actually a grey suit man. He was more of a grey suit man, but I thought it was a great way of describing that need for a daily routine. Putting on the Grey Suit, by Dennis O'Driscoll. George Herbert wrote, the folly of distracted men. But often we forget, we will not pass this way again. Putting on the grey suit, we are set in motion, en route like the morning memo. The keyboard is the juju that we touch, the answer machine, a sentinel to watch over us. Like clockwork, we finish and commence. The days we circle are marked with an X. We write reports and pass away a life as foot soldiers making footnotes, field workers among the sheaves, counting down the office hours, the middle years, until they reach the last hour of exhaustion when we close the ledger, put down the pen, and gather what we worked to earn. Some years ago, during one of the periods that there was a Bush in the White House, and I can't remember whether it was senior or junior, I remember having an argument with a colleague. We were actually coming out of a Paul Simon concert, and she was fulminating over policy in which seems rather mild by today's situation in American politics at the time. As a kind of response to that critique of our own country, I wrote this poem called A Different America. The fact that there are two Simon songs referenced in the first two lines, the poem has really very little to do with Paul Simon, though he comes in and out of the poem. But the point I was trying to make was there were lots of great things, and there still are, about that great, vast country. A Different America. Angels in the architecture. Diamonds on the soles of her shoes. That's what the singer saw when he made his American tunes. Songs of a different America, the horizons that Audubon scanned for birds of the air, flowers of the land. On all sides, the many voices, Whitman, Melville, Thomas Merton, the solitude of his hermitage, looking up at stars on the flag, stars in the firmament. And Frost's New England woods with their groves of abundance, the cities with their citadels and subways, their heroes cast in bronze. That's what the singer saw, a different America, the one he turned into vision songs, folk canticles, with a rhythm of calypso, boom bang of jazz, songs to make us join the dance. A few years ago, in America, in Minnesota, I met one of my poetry heroes, Robert Bly. Although I'm probably, Bly and the poet James Wright had one of the first obsessions I had was the poetry of each one, which in the 1960s, they produced a magazine called The 60s. Which came my way via another poet, James Liddy, who was in Milwaukee. But I met Bly kind of by accident. I had been on a public radio program, and I was reading a poem, and I recognized that I had borrowed a full line from Bly's work, and I reckon I wouldn't get away with it in Minnesota. So I spoke about my admiration for Bly, and shortly after that, someone contacted me and said, "Well, would you like to meet him?" And I did, and it was a kind of interesting encounter. He's still going strong. He's a poet laureate of Minnesota, but the poem is a kind of study of that experience of meeting him, meeting Robert Bly. He studies us the way a sailor studies the horizon, the poet with broad shoulders, a corn picker's shadow, who yesterday saw a face that gave off light, who today sits with his back to the door, his gaze directed at the apple of his eye. He is back from going his own way, days on the farm, nights at the desk of solitude, through cropland where the thresher was abandoned, or leaving his tracks in snow that blanked the field of white roses. He is listening for his shift in the earth's axis, under the weight of the granaries, and knows where to find the stolen child in the hiding places of the Lake Isle and Madison. He is listening too for the mouse that scratches the floor of his heavenly mansion. And in that same sequence of poems set in the American Midwest, there's one, a kind of homage to that great river, which I kind of didn't realize, I associate the Mississippi with the kind of hot south delta region of America, but up in the colder north it exists there too, and that's where its origins are. Mississippi, which is section 9 of this sequence of poems. Mississippi. The local river carries its name from one end to the other. From the lake in the north to the delta in the south, passing through the land of God, the first stranger it meets is the devil learning to swim, plunging in but keeping away from the christening pool. Sometimes it turns to mud in the muddy creek, or breaks loose to seek the governor's mansion on the way to Baton Rouge. In its waters there are bones, there is blood. There are towns that need it, and towns it washes away in a punishing flood. Little has changed since the slave looked at it and saw freedom, since an image of the river was painted to hang in the county museum. The local river knows the lonely despair of the loner and the light of transfiguration, light that shows the poverty of trees when they are out of season. Emily mentioned this book, The Yellow River. This has been a kind of two-year project with artists for whom I've long had great admiration. I think he's probably one of our greatest landscape painters since Jack Yates, Sean McSweeney. How it came about, despite my strong Dublin connections, my mother was a County Meath woman, and Sean's father came from the same parish in County Meath, and I was invited by the Sussex Art Centre in Navan to do a project and select an artist that could have been a composer or photographer. I immediately wanted to work with Sean. So 2 years ago I set about, the project is really all about memory and shared memory that we have of kind of the Meath landscape and family. I wrote poems, sent them to Sean, he would respond with images. It's currently an exhibition with Solstice and Navan, with the poems and the paintings sort of side by side, and it's been certainly one of the highlights of my own creative life. So I'll read a few of these poems. The first one is called Yanks, keeping kind of the American theme going. Four of my mother's siblings emigrated to the States in the 1920s, and it was always a big to-do when one of them came back in like childhood in the 60s. And of course, the locals always refer to them as Yanks. Yanks. The house of dereliction is rotting from within, gathering dust, falling to bits. In its small rooms, sparrows have made their nests and sing the only lullabies this house has heard since the year of a difficult birth. Between the wars, it was deserted for a sailing ticket, a New York job. Now Yanks, who returned to the spot, stopped 5 minutes and aimed their cameras to take a picture of the remnant of what once was the heart of things. At the tourist office, they receive a map of the heritage sites and good advice on where to cross the river, where to find monuments off the beaten track, but seen on postcards showing the treasures of the Boyne. Since childhood, they have listened to lore from a family archive, the names of distant cousins. They cannot stay long, just enough time for the scenic drive. Another country is waiting for them. One of the, I suppose, oddities in this sequence of poems is a poem about the death of Jim Reeves. If anyone remembers Jim Reeves.
Yes.
Jim Reeves was phenomenally popular singer, country singer in Ireland. It's funny when you delve into memory what surfaces. And as I was thinking back to, although I grew up in the centre of Dublin, literally smelling the Liffey and smelling Guinness's Brewery, I was sent up to my grandmother's farm every summer. I think it was 1962 or 3, hot August day, there was a sort of routine or tradition. It was haymaking time, and I was usually sent in to get buttermilk for the haymakers. And the kitchen radio, the announcer just said that Jim Reeves had died in a plane crash. Which just stuck with me to this day. The day Jim Reeves died, I was haymaking in a long meadow in Meath. Jim Reeves was never my kind of idol, a voice too soft at the edges. But I knew his death left a hole in country music, a sorrow on the prairie. There were tears in Texas, the rodeo was cancelled. Strong men cried in Nashville and Kells and west of the Shannon. Road menders stopped digging the roads and filling the holes. Their tea water turned into vapor and kettles left unattended. At the end of the day, radio DJs abandoned their playlists. That night we forgot to close the gates, lock the hen house. Cattle strayed, fox came. The last time I read that a week ago, someone came up to me afterwards and said, did the fox really come? This is called the Old Castle Dance, Old Castle Up. North Mead. When I was a bit older, 17 or 18, I brought a friend, my only friend who had a car at the time. He had a little Mini, and we went on a little drive around County Mead looking for trouble, and we found it in Oldcastle. The Oldcastle Dance. In 1971, at the Oldcastle Dance, it was bubblegum and slow set ballads. We held our breaths and waited for the secret signs when the DJ put on the Jackson 5. There was glitter ball for glitz, its 100 mirrors showing the new beginners learning the rituals of the dance pavilion. The girls of summer still had names chosen from the list of saints. They were lissom, sinuous, and in their night disguises they looked unlike the truer versions of themselves. Dreamers staring into the distance, convent girls in modest dress. The air was thick with their perfumes, In another age, they might have been the temptress in the opera, Botticelli's muse, or the Queen of Sheba when she stood before Solomon. When the book was launched up in Navan about 2 weeks ago, someone said to me, you better watch out if any of these turn up again. One of the most significant things about that period, that actual location for me, is it's the first place I wrote poetry in the summer of 1968. I was up in the country, and I had taken with me, I was starting to read poetry and become interested in it, and I had taken with me a book called The Mersey Poets, I think it was called. And I attempted my own first poems that particular summer. And this is the last poem in the sequence in The Yellow River. It's called The Year I Turned to Poetry. The year I turned to poetry, 16 years of dreaming were all I had when my first muse put the scribe's pen in my hand. Now my life was four times that, and I am back where it all began, looking for the midden that expanded like the universe in a corner of the yard, under daytime's silver birches, nighttime's bottleneck of stars. It was here my forefathers labored for years, grinding hard clods into fine clay. Their house of sanctuary still stands, but rooms have been added, and I cannot find the window where they scanned the Milky Way. It was here I first looked for words to describe the sacred and absurd. I looked in the furrows, the stubble, beneath pine needles lying where they fell, under leaves that dropped from branches of the elm. I tend to be a slow writer. I produce a lot of drafts before I'm happy with something, and something I always recommend in workshops. But this is actually the quickest poem I probably ever wrote. It was during a night of insomnia called How Goes the Night. How goes the night? It goes like this. Sleepless since the thumping beat of a car stereo broke the peace, and the headlight beams crossed the ceiling, going east, then disappearing in the corner where the spider lives. Idle thoughts, erotic longings, a list of tasks to think about, but no lush soundtrack to sweeten the dark in the theatre of the mind, just the vigil of a digital clock, watching with the red eyes of a god. If I may, I'm going to read some newer poems. Sorry for checking the time on it. I follow that The Year I Turned to Poetry poem is about the beginnings of a life in poetry, really. This poem is called Birthday Blues at 65, and which was a gift from me to me. And it's really kind of throwing some doubt on that whole life of, you know, where does it get you, writing poetry? Birthday Blues at 65. Have I squandered a life writing poetry? The morning poems, midnight nouns and verbs crossed out, tossed away, or wasted words, my treasury. Was it all a cure for boredom, a kind of servitude, a rapture since poetry arrived, seasoned and lyrical, and gave its knock upon the window? Have I been unwise with the time I had, writing stanzas that became my mask, chasing ghost sonnets, waiting on street corners for an image to pass and stumble into my arms? When others spent Sunday in the park, hunted for the sound of the sea, I stayed indoors and fine-tuned the melody, listening for the reticent heartbeat of an ode or elegy, wishing for one song to add to the troubadour's repertoire. On the morning that the news of Leonard Cohen's death came, I was phoned by the Irish Times, and I spent the morning at home writing something for the following day's paper. In the course of the morning, I was getting a lot of texts, you know, people kind of going into a kind of mourning. But they were all coming from poets, which I thought really interesting, given his own brilliant creative gifts as a poet, which kind of are often overlooked because he was recognized as a singer. Anyway, later on, in response to that, this poem was written. It's called The Heartbroken Poets. All the heartbroken poets remain indoors listening to El Cohen, his harvest of darkness, his psalms in a language ancient and new. This song with a chorus as clear as a mission bell, that song as lyrical as the rain that fell on Yeats's grave. Keats climbed the Spanish steps, Byron arrived on the shores of Greece, but this poet came into the shade of a Georgian mansion, two sisters singing at his side, one with a harp, both in the gyre of a cartwheel dance. With night coming on, he sang in the gloaming, sang for the lovers on the mountain, May the light of evening, is Adele, sound like prayer in the synagogue, a chant in the house of Zen. All the heartbroken poets light the candles and pour the wine into the parting glass to raise a toast to the lady's man. The monk in robes, gone to meet Lorca's ghost, gone with four final words, I'm ready, my lord. The following poem was written last November, in response to the American election result. And I had planned it. My son is a photographer, and most years we kind of do a Christmas card together. I write the words, he produces an image. But when I produced this poem at home, I was asked, was I trying to ruin Christmas for everyone? So that the card was never created, but the poem's about to appear elsewhere in the United States. It's called The Child in the Crib, and it has an epithet from Gillian Clark. In our democracy, in our dangerous century, words can set an angry crowd on fire. To the child in the crib. I want you safe from all bad news, from knowledge that induces a fearful shiver. The war in the East, and the war that begins with the promise that it will be over by Christmas. I want you safe from hatreds that have no day of rest, from the charnel house and the sound of dread when two armies march in monstrous ranks, the bugler out of key, the drummer repeating his blundering beats. I want you safe when the zealots feed on the grapes of wrath and speak of walls they will build, and turning back the clock with the key that also opens Pandora's box. Ardmore, winter 1947, after I was in Ardmore last year doing a workshop, I visited the grave of a number of foreign sailors whose bodies had been washed up during the terrible winter of 1947, when their ship, which I think was bringing coal from England, they were all Eastern Europeans as far as I can remember, it foundered, and the bodies were washed up just outside the village of Ardmore, and they were all buried there. Ardmore, winter 1947. The east wind has had its knives out. The winter fires were in need of fuel. Everywhere, machines were idle, mill wheels stopped their jar. The way to every door was lost in blizzards like a rain of steel. At Matten Falls, loose water stood on hold, icicled, like canvas in the studio when the artist gives up or dies. Each day, the new ice age renewed itself. Not even the old people could remember such bewilderment of the last time the midwife failed to arrive. The birds of Ardmore were nowhere to be seen when the mariners drowned. 11 strangers with foreign names heaved in by the sea, beached upon the cold slab of the shore. The whole town came to bury them, first in mounds of snow, then in frozen ground. A book of white, a countryside dressed in christening robes. I'll read a Dublin poem, if I may, in Cork. This is called Where Eros Met His Aphrodite. It's obviously a particular time is identified with the first stanza, which refers to the Six-Day War in the 1960s. But it's also, one of the most shocking things that's happened in my native city is the closure of Cleary's in O'Connell Street. And Cleary's clock was dear to many of us and was a point of rendezvous. So the poem is also a kind of homage to that particular location and to some of our past lives. I start with a quote from the American great poet of Detroit, the boat is displaced and break your heart, which we can all say about most of the places that we live in, to some degree. When Eros met his Aphrodite. The Arabs and the Jews were halfway through a six-day war. All we could do was hope that the scaremongers were wrong, that the soothsayers had not seen what they thought they saw. Horses in the Saturday steeplechase had names like wind in the gap. Sunday was the day of ease. On Monday, the shirts and sheets and aprons hung in the drying breeze of little backyards. Still in their 50s hats, all the men had smoker's cough. The women gazed like window cats at neighbours on the warpath. At the end of afternoon, the newsboys and newsvendors held aloft the news and shouted loud enough to shake the corners where they stood. It was a city of damp evenings, a resting place for fog, where the hands of Cleary's clock told us we were late, and on the street below, by the blaze of a big shop window, romance had its ebb and flow, of Eros met his Aphrodite. The poet Michael Smith was my first mentor in poetry. He died 2 years ago, and this is an elegy in his memory. Michael was a great translator of Spanish poetry, as well as being a kind of essential Dublin poet. Thanksgiving in memory of Michael Smith. About his life, the facts are in order, but the poet is missing and an elegy is called for, or at least a thanksgiving for his book of dedications. His days when you listen to a schoolroom clock that seemed slower than time, slower than the narrative of Caesar's wars. A journey to the village of stone and dust, but they still had Good Friday crucifixions and the hired musicians played all night the flamenco songs of Andalusia. The poet is missing. Has he gone to Machado's garden or Mangan's dust house? Perhaps to blend with the colours of the Alhambra, seek again the after-rain stillness of the air of western Connemara. No, he has gone the hidden ways close to the river mouth where his song began, in the clamour of the bird market, whistle of the North Sea treasure man. I've always been a fan of the Kinks' Waterloo Sunset, and this is called Waterloo Sunrise. John Minahan, who will probably be in these parts over the next few days, told me great stories about his time in Soho. In the 60s, and my first encounter with that that London was in the 1970s. And I just sort of tried to capture something of that era in this particular poem, which I've dedicated to John, called Waterloo Sunrise. Thames water under the bridges, the busker with nicotine fingers, neon and Piccadilly showing the jazz colours of electricity. The Parliament clock fluent at midnight, a poet who sits in a workers' cafe reading the poems of Rosemary Tonks, the trade routes of Soho and young Julie Christie on cinema posters, the bartender's story of suicides in the underground stations, tea rooms, coffee bars, rooms with a damp patch and a slight smell of gas, the Waterloo sunrise, seen by debutantes going home from the dance, 6 hours late but not in haste, young beauties with a faint trace of perfumes, hour by hour lost their allure, love of life and carpe diem is what they believed in, those girls just risen from sunbeds, just back from the Côte d'Azur. And given the date that tomorrow is, I'll end with a love poem. I think it's appropriate. Very original title, Chant d'Amour. You lay with me in a high room in Manhattan and in a draft-riddled caravan. You lay with me and made me laugh by the riverside in Glengariff on grass that stained your summer dress and among the daisies that you chained to hide the love bites on your neck. I lay with you waiting for thunder to clear, lightning to cease, or watching sunrise give the kiss of life to our windows facing east. You lay with me naked, and lay with me wrapped in blankets, quilts, and soft eiderdown, in heat wave and Atlantic storm, with sand in our hair and barley corn. You lay with me on the shore beside a shrinking sea, in a hayfield under the acorn tree. Thank you all very much for listening.